Look up at the California state flag sometime. Right there in the middle, walking across a patch of grass, is a grizzly bear. It's on our license plates, our state park signs, our jerseys, and it's even on the artwork for this podcast. And yet, it hasn't existed in California for over 100 years. The last confirmed wild grizzly in the state was killed in the 1920s. We put the animal on our flag right around the same time we finished wiping it out. And I think that tells you something about California. The way we love a story about abundance, about the golden hills and the endless beauty, even when the reality underneath that story is a lot more complicated and a whole lot more haunted. I'm Jordan Maddox. This is the History of California podcast. And my guest this week is Dr. Daniel Rivers, who teaches at San Jose State University. And we're focused on their book, California Futures, Haunted Ecologies, Decolonial Relations, forthcoming from Duke University Press. The book follows a single, powerful thread across the state, from the eradication of the grizzly, to the making of Central Valley agriculture, to the dam removals on the Klamath River, all the way to the housing encampments of Oakland. And through it all, Dr. Rivers is asking a hopeful question. What would it look like to build a more livable California? Let's go meet Dr. Daniel Rivers. So, Dr. Rivers, you're the first repeat guest I've had, I think, in a very long time. And our first conversation was about John Steinbeck, given your time at the Steinbeck Center at San Jose State. And I wanted to ask kind of one connecting question before we jump into the subject of today, which is your new book. What Steinbeck book do you think is most resonant with the themes of this book that you've written about haunting and ecology and California and memory and history?
Yeah. Ooh, that's a good one. It's tempting to say To a God Unknown because I write about that one in this book and because it does have so many of these sort of worldly themes. But I also find that book to be a bit apocalyptic, and hopefully mine isn't too apocalyptic.
No, that's where I initially went in my head.
Yeah. I mean, I guess part, I could say the Long Valley just because of the sort of range, right? And it does go into, it even goes into agriculture and water in one of the stories, and the red pony, of course, with animals and the idea of the frontier and the fantasy of the frontier, especially that shows up pretty powerfully at the end of the red pony stories. But yeah, maybe that one, certainly Grapes of Wrath. I think that rereading Grapes of Wrath 2 years ago, I was stunned by the level of critique he brought to the collusion that was happening at the county level. And I think we see a very similar collusion in terms of pesticide politics, right? Where like pesticide control agents or PCAs, who are the ones who are like empowered to regulate on the local level, are like 90% work in product sales that are deeply invested in like the county GDP and maintaining a robust agricultural economy. So in that way, rereading Grapes of Wrath recently, I was like, oh, damn. Yeah.
So give us, before we jump into the meat of the book, because I have a lot of questions about some specific chapters, but what was the impetus to start working on this project?
Yeah. So I think the impetus, and, you know, To a God Unknown was there pretty early on for me with it too. But the impetus was I was doing a lot of reading in California history, and I was noticing that there was just a sense of California's inevitability, right? What Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who wrote an Indigenous Peoples History of the U.S., calls unconscious manifest destiny. For her, it's when she has her students draw the shape of the U.S. in the early 19th century, and they always draw the contiguous U.S., that sense of like, it's inevitable. And I think as I was reading more, like really digging into 19th century California history with questions about like agriculture and grizzlies, I just noticed how strong that trope was. And I think I wanted to, partially because of where I am historically as a scholar, where conversations are right now, what my training was like, but also just because of what I was curious about, I wanted to try to see if I could get around the kind of idea of California as a concept.
Yeah.
You know, and try to get to the margins of that idea and see what comes into view.
So One of the first images that you provide us in the book is the image of California as an island. So can you explain why you wanted to start with a cartographic error to start your book?
Yeah, and there's so many. The one I've got in the book is one of the lovelier ones in terms of just the color and shape, but there's so many of these portraits of California as an island. And I think it was really, to me, making the connection between that, the cartographic fantasy of the Manila galleon trade, right? Spanish ships coming from Acapulco to Manila and back, needing a port to rest and refuel because of the supreme mortality rate. And that being the early speculations of California, I think that idea came together with, I remember reading about the ways that the Central Valley floodplain used to look like an inland ocean, right? Like a miles long inland ocean. And I think when those two things resonated, I suddenly understood the sort of island of California beyond just a fantasy from a Spanish novel, but into misapprehension of the environment. There's this concept of shifting baseline syndrome. Right? The environmental conditions you're born into feel like the natural environmental conditions because that's what your memory has access to. And California is just so many generations deep into iterative experiences of shifting baseline syndrome, right? Or just our sense of of California is so detached from material environmental reality. And I think living in this moment, we're seeing what happens when that fantasy, the cracks really start to show under mega drought, climate change, mega fire, all the megas.
Well, let's jump into the title of the book because I want to unpack that because that really sets our course here. I want to start with a kind of, I see it as three units. You have your future unit, you have the decolonial element, and you have your haunting element. So I want to start with future. So why a plural for future?
Totally. In that one, I'm also indebted to Amy Bong. Her book, Migrant Futures, and really thinking about future both as a form of imagination and projection, like what could the future be like, but also the really pressing on the financial speculation element of it. That, like, in California, so many environmental decisions have been made in order to foster certain kinds of, so many environmental decisions have been made in order to foster certain kinds of financial futures. And so, in thinking about California futures, there's a pun between speculative fiction and speculative finance. Yeah. And then environmental futurity as what gets caught up in the sort of in that process, or maybe what's the meeting ground between those forms of imagining.
We'll come back to decolonial when we talk about the Central Valley and we talk about land and decolonizing it. But I want to tap into this idea of haunted ecologies. I was really intrigued in reading your book and then doing an investigative tour through Avery Gordon's sociology of haunting. There's a little Jacques Derrida in there too. Can you unpack what Avery Gordon is doing there and how it relates to your project?
Totally. And I think Avery Gordon's language has really diffused through cultural studies, especially in this concept of the otherwise, right? Both as a site of political dreaming, especially in Black studies and Black thought, otherwise worlds is the both imminent. Right, it's happening right now, and also as a possibility for another way of being or another political future or another arrangement of power. But Gordon gets us there, and her writing's so beautiful. But using haunting as a framework to think about what are the futures that were foreclosed, right? And in this way, I think she's also working a bit with Walter Benjamin and the Angel of History kind of image or concept, but this idea of what are the futures that could have been if things had been different? And what if we take that possibility very seriously? And I think that becomes a really, pardon me, important frame for thinking alongside like California Native tribes and their futures and past, right? And their foreclosed futures. Same with so many different communities who live at the margins or who've been dispossessed as part of the project of building California. Yeah. And I think that otherwise, especially in this moment, is really a potent way to think because the present moment can feel so overdetermined, right? And so many of the structures that folks rely on to give access to something like equity have been compromised. But I think the otherwise is a site of both dreaming and possibility becomes really powerful, right? And I think haunting helps us get there. But as in any good ghost story, you have to confront what could have been and you have to confront the echoes that are happening. I think in California, a really powerful example is mega fire. Right. Mega fire is a haunting we live with because of the unacknowledged environmental choices in the past that have resulted in lands and especially forests that are so fire prone because of centuries of excluding fire, excluding cultural burning, and creating these really simplified environments, and then putting lodgepole pine and other flammable species in there. Like, I think that it really, to me, captures both haunting as a force that demands to be reckoned with, and also that classic kind of haunting story of going back to the root to figure out what is the violence that, or what is echoing out in our present moment.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was reading kind of the way you dealt with these topics, I was torn between kind of this metaphorical impulse, but also there's something ontological going, something in space and substance. So how do you think about how you're using that term in that kind of that polarity between just a metaphor that helps understand the world versus like something that exists in space and time that's influencing how the world unfolds?
Totally. Yeah. I think that there are many knowledge traditions that take haunting very seriously. I also think, in general, haunting as a concept is a pretty settler colonial framework for thinking. And one of the things that I try to do in the book, hopefully with some success, is have it like shifting between different ontologies or different ways of knowing and not trying to collapse them into a unified way of knowing. And I think haunting for me as a settler and for so many readers functions as a metaphor to help make things explicit or understandable. At the same time that I want to hold, and it's been important to me to hold in the book, that like so much of what it's doing is reckoning with like real histories of violence, right? I've got a friend, Carrie Malloy at San Jose State, who's a Yurok, and he said in an interview once, every Native person who's living in North America is doing so because someone died to make sure that they could survive, right? Or that their family could survive. And I think that is, there's a weight there that I think haunting gestures toward, even without totally touching, right? But a weight of, I don't know, yeah, the history of the dead, right? The history of the violence that so often gets obscured by the image of California, or the idea of California as a site of abundance or ease or possibility.
And I guess there's a bunch of other questions I could ask about this. It's interesting. I remember reading, he's a kind of conservative Catholic, but I remember reading G.K. Chesterton in college and thinking about the democracy of the dead and thinking about tradition in that way and the dead's role that they should serve and how we see the world and make choices. I'm curious just how this research has influenced the way you think the production of history should change. Does that make sense as a question? How you think, given that the dead are continuing to play a role, either through echoes, through the written word, through currents in the system, like how does that change how we should think about writing history?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll say I work at a teaching-based university. JSU is an R2, but the teaching load's a 3-3. So we're spending a lot of time in the classroom. And part of that as a writer is that I will bring elements of research or text or ideas I'm working with into the classroom. And I think one of the things that I've learned, I'm starting my 14th year teaching in the CSU along with some other places, but is that as a 40-something scholar of cultural studies, like I have learned to metabolize histories of violence as a part of my work, right? And it's part of what I study. And I've got a different ability to soak that experience or that reading than my students. And I've learned very early on that like how we approach thinking about the history, how we think about histories of violence, especially important ones, needs to be balanced with look toward the future or look toward the histories of resistance that were happening at the same time, but the antibodies within that history, because I think that it becomes really, if we don't temper our exploration of violence with an exploration of resistance, possibility, the creation of alternatives in history and today, then we really risk becoming spectators to that violence, right? And in that, along with creating difficulties in metabolizing and retaining that history, I think it also acculturates us to a certain posture of being in the world that's incredibly unhelpful, to put it mildly, but it also doesn't inspire action.
So there's the attachment of agency, in that element there. Let's jump to some of the vignettes from your book. I want to start with grizzlies. So I've told the story on this podcast maybe one, two, maybe three times of the Bear Flag Revolt and the creation of California's state flag. Do you mind giving us a brief overview, a slight backstory on grizzlies in California and essentially their demise?
So specifically grizzlies or the revolt or
Let's start with the Bear Flag Revolt, and then we'll talk about the grizzly demise.
So as I understand it, the Bear Flag Revolt happened in the 1840s, I think 1846. And there were more US settlers coming to the region, especially for trapping or to set up farms. Alta California was at the northern reaches of Mexico and had a lower population and less infrastructural investment, especially Northern California at the time. And so in response to the in-migration of US settlers, the governor of California of Alta California declared their land claims invalid. John C. Fremont responded by raising the US flag in which peak is it? It's near Monterey, right? Monterey Peak.
Yeah, I'm not remembering the name, but
Then goes through the Central Valley around Sutter and around Sacramento, rallying people to then head up to Vallejo to take over the garrison there in a sort of bloodless coup. They create a flag that has a grizzly that looks like a pig on it and raise that. Mariano Vallejo's daughter remembers them as being crooks and thieves and rapists, and certainly they cut a lot of violence through native communities as the group was rallying together and heading to Vallejo's home. And from there's like a series of skirmishes between them and the Mexican government happening around sort of San Francisco and present day Marin, right? And it ultimately is not the moment that turns California into U.S. holding. That happens at the end of the Mexican-American War, but it's seen as precipitating statehood, and I think the flag memorializes that. And the grizzly is significant because California had one-fifth of North America's grizzlies, more or less. They were everywhere. They were huge. There's also a way in sort of the bear and bull fights that used to be held both under Spanish and, or sorry, Mexican governance and the U.S., that the bull was figured as a sort of Latine or Spanish descended symbol, and the grizzly became the sort of like symbol of powerful American imperial manhood.
So we have a lot of early kind of mythologized tellings of grizzlies from settler colonial documents. How should we view those? What information is pertinent there? Maybe that's on the page and then it's behind the page.
Yeah, I think one of the things it does is really can give us a sense of like the environmental consciousness of early US settlers, most of whom were not experienced with the outdoors, right? We have this idea that they're all sort of Ron Swanson and Dude Land, like
Trappers that
proto-masculine.
know all the different aspects of how to survive in nature.
But most of what they ate, they brought at stores, right? Or grew in home gardens. Sorry, I lost my train of thought for a second.
We were talking about the narratives about grizzlies from these settler
Thank
colonial.
you. So I think there's a way in which it reflects an atmosphere of environmental fear. Also tells us something about the kinds of environments that they were used to living in. I also think that it becomes a fad, right? Like grizzliness as a trope, as a form of embodiment through bearskin coats and hats and eating grizzly meat, which was very popular. I think it becomes a sort of a cultural touchstone for settlers to both embody a kind of frontier manliness or an idea about it, pardon me, and to project fears about the fact that the environments that they were in were unfamiliar. They were populated by species that they didn't know how to reckon with, and also by native folks who, if you're a rancher, your cattle could easily be eaten by a passing grizzly, but also you are worried about, or you would be worried about raids on your livestock because the level of environmental and political disruption that settlers brought in California resulted in a lot of Native folks who found their traditional ways of eating, their traditional societies, like transformed or disrupted. And so I think, yeah, what gets romanticized as this sort of like dead woody lawless zone, I think is just a territory that was experiencing a lot of like that, where there was just a lot of uncertainty, and grizzlies became an embodiment of responding to that uncertainty with violence, I think, in a posture of domination.
Yeah, it's interesting when we have these conversations, and this could be a meta conversation about your whole book, right? Which is, there's this kind of history of violence or this traumatic history of erasure, and then we want to do something about it to address it. But then when we try to address it, there's other kind of unforeseen consequences by reintroducing something that's been removed from a natural environment. And I was reading some of the debate around reintroducing grizzlies to the wild, and there was an LA Times editorial board pushback that basically said something along the lines of, there's just not, the ecosystem can't maintain it now given how much it's changed. So how do you think about the ethics and the methodology of something like a reintroduction of a, to be honest, a predator into California?
Totally. Yeah. I think if we want to foster more resilient ecosystems in the time of climate change, we need to get used to predators. We are a very technologically advanced set of cultures, right? And the fact alone that thriving societies of people cohabitated, like native people cohabitated for something like 10,000s of years, seems to suggest that it's possible, right? And perhaps it's a matter of will and a matter of political will. And also experimentation and understanding. That being
We
said,
survive with mountain lions running around the Hollywood Hills. I mean,
yeah.
sometimes a dog gets eaten, but that's kind of nature. It's just part of the cycle of life. You know, I don't know.
Totally. And it also reflects the vibrancy or degradation of the environments that they're relying on for food too, right? If they're moving into human-occupied environments, that's not the preference. And I mean, I attended a meeting about a year and a half ago about the possibility of grizzly introduction or reintroduction that was predominantly attended by California Native Nations who are exploring the possibility. And I think Tejon and Yurok are probably the tribes who are maybe the closest. But ultimately, I think how the group that day was thinking about it, A, we had a group of folks from the Grizzly Alliance up in Canada and First Nations territory, who was talking. We had representatives of First Nations communities who were living with grizzlies and using grizzly for viewing tourism as a form of financial and professional engagement for the tribe. But they had a set of practices, right? And if a grizzly is coming into the community, then that's something that's acknowledged. If it happens a second time, then action's taken. But also, it's taken in a way that, with respect for that creature, often those grizzly pelts go on into cultural or ceremonial use, right? In terms of California, I don't know that I'm saying that we should lose grizzlies tomorrow, but I think if we can get to a place in California legislature and wildlife and fish and game recognized 2024 as the year of the grizzly with an eye toward reintroduction. But I think in some ways it's a horizon of, it's a great way to think about what steps would we need to take to make that possible. And then put some pressure behind those. I think beavers, like grizzlies, beavers are ecosystem engineers, and they can do great things for making ecosystems robust and paving the way for it to be supportive of megafauna, right? Like grizzlies. The Yurok have one of the largest contiguous land bases, especially in California among native tribes. And I think they, from what I remember at that meeting, I think, A, they're already introducing the condor, but then black bears are probably a good step, right? And if we can learn to manage introducing black bears into territories where they've been excluded and see those effects, that might be another indicator species along on the journey toward introducing grizzlies. Ultimately, I think we have, I think there's a possibility, but I think there has to be a desire. And at present, I think the percent of Californians was the recent figure I heard, don't realize that grizzlies were eradicated. So in some ways, folks are already cool with it. You
You're
think
like, I
it's
saw a
already
brown
happening.
bear the other day. That was a grizzly, right? Like, yeah, a little smaller. Let's transition to the next vignette I want to talk about,
Sure.
which is where I live, the Central Valley. And I've been dealing with glyphosate conversations for years, having lived here and lived near agriculture, industrial scale agriculture. What was a new concept is this idea of pollution as colonialism, which to me wasn't necessarily intuitive. I can see the cross currents, but I had to have it spelled out in some ways. So can you talk about how pollution is connected to these bigger narratives of colonialism that we're tapping into here?
Totally. And I think maybe even a good place to start is nature as colonialism or wildness as colonialism, wilderness. So this idea that there's land that is not occupied by people, that is separate and that is self-sustaining and that can bear a certain level of toxicity without issue, that is a colonial framework, right? The idea that we could have a garbage dump, right? And that's not going to at some point have an environmental effect. So pollution as colonialism, I should say that concept comes from Max Libiorun, who's up in, I believe, Nova Scotia, but has a great book by the same of the same title that was really instructive to me. And part of how Max gets there is they're looking at a famous study of the level of toxicity that a river can bear. And their intervention is like, what if we say a river can't bear toxicity? What this idea that there is an acceptable threshold is itself a colonial framework that is meant to facilitate sort of industry or these fantasies that are like trash or byproducts have a place to go where it's fine. And I think it radically reorients things if we think about there is no space that's outside of relation.
Can you just layer that interpretive lens over industrial agriculture in the Central Valley? How can we use that, what we were just discussing, as a tool to interpret what's going on right now?
Yeah, totally. I think of our current, especially consolidated agricultural systems, because we have a lot of types of agriculture in California, but consolidated monocultural systems that are owned largely by big corporations, like those tracts have accumulated over time as a result of drought often, right? Small farmers default. Bank of America's Transamerica Company or someone else buys up a bunch of land, increases their holdings. And then around the 1940s, monoculture really gets going, right? Because we have the production of genetically modified crops like corn that are suddenly uniform. They can grow in closer proximity and they can be harvested by machines because they're built to have stronger stalks and to grow in rows, right? That coincides with the development of nitrogen-based fertilizers, which are a byproduct of bombs from World War I, right? The ability to fix nitrogen in the soil. So then you're not worrying about a field regenerating by going fallow, right? Or by putting kind of inputs like scat or fertilizer or other things that you've got a chemical fertilizer to go with those crops. And then pesticides are the third part of this, right? Where whenever you nature hates a monoculture, right? To the extent that nature exists, if you have a monoculture, it becomes very vulnerable to pests and disease that can spread through. And so pesticides become a way for controlling this. But any insect species that you're going to control for with pesticides, there's an environmental kind of phenomenon called blowback, where if you kill all the pests, they're going to come back in population much stronger. So it becomes an iterative process. And I think by trying to solve the problem of how we do we grow a bunch of corn or whatever in a small, contained, single species tract, we got caught up in the problem of pivoting within that framework as opposed to acknowledging the sort of harms or consequences of that framework. In the US, like a really easy way to look at these consequences is to look at the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico, right? So all the farmland in the Midwest around the Mississippi watershed, farmers will often use more fertilizer to try to guard against crop loss because farmers are working on such a small margin of profit anyway, in such a debt system that they're working within the system where it makes sense to put more fertilizer than you're going to need sometimes. That runs off into waters. From the Mississippi, we can trace it down to the Gulf of Mexico, where you see this large zone of just like algae, like a dead zone, right? Where if you have so much algae in the water, it prevents oxygen from getting into the water, it can alter the pH and chemistry, and then you have a big fish kill. In California, we experience that in our waterways just through runoff, right? Like the runoff of pesticides, the runoff of fertilizers. For the longest, I think until the late aughts, it was legal to let livestock run off into the water, right? And that it's one thing if these are like sort of organic compounds, but it's another when they're chemicals that are designed to have a half-life of 50 years. If that's resting in the environment, or if it's getting into the water, or if you have pesticide drift due to wind and or fog, then yeah, then we really get the containment becomes impossible of those. Even if we decide like we're somehow focused on only using it in this tract of land, you really can't control how water moves, how fog moves, how wind moves.
Yeah. Well, it's a morbid topic for me because I live on some of this haunted land. You know?
Yeah,
And
yeah.
that's something that's always in the back of my mind. And sometimes it comes to the fore, but it's like you said, it's something that will follow us. And it's those futures that you're talking about, and in this case, negative ones that are going to stay with us. And yeah, anyway, I could go down a rabbit trail, but I want to ask you now about the Klamath River. I have an interesting question to ask you, which came up in a previous podcast that I did. I interviewed one of the lawyers that was involved in the case to take down the dam along the
Oh,
Klamath
cool.
River, which was a really fun conversation, a great story of surmounting obstacles. And what was one of the interesting aspects of the conversation, and one that I prodded her on, this person that I interviewed, was just the legal system has been used to subjugate Indigenous people for a long time. And now Indigenous people are taking that same legal system to fight and resurrect the things that were taken. And so it's interesting to hear her kind of discuss how she thinks about law, given that it was a tool used to hurt her people and now to help them. But what I wanted to ask you about was something that came up earlier in the conversation. When we were discussing displacement, I started talking, or at least going over the narrative of how her people were displaced, the stories, the violence. And she didn't want to talk about that. She felt that the narratives have centered victimhood too centrally. And so she wanted to focus our conversation on the story of triumph, removing this dam or getting this dam removed legally. So I guess my question to you is, how do you think about the politics of which parts of the stories we tell? Because it seems complicated, because it, to me, and this was my pushback to her, was that you have to explain what was taken in order to understand why it was so hard to get it back. But at the same time, I don't want to just exclusively tell that kind of sad Indigenous story over and over again, but it feels like it's necessary. So I guess for you, given that you wrote about it in this chapter, how do you think about how we tell Indigenous stories?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks. Yeah, I think centrally it depends on whose voice is leading the conversation, right? And I think we're at a time where it's really important to recognize and support Indigenous leadership, and especially thought leadership and political leadership in these areas. For me, as a settler coming into this conversation, I tried to be very aware of like, what are my goals and aims, right? Thinking back to decolonizing methodologies, Smith's work on the paper curtain, right? And I don't know, the privilege that so many academics and so many white settler thinkers have to easily gain an audience and to move without care through this territory. Yeah, in terms of the question of history, I think that the history of environmental transformations is really important. And I think J.M. Bacon has this concept, colonial ecological violence, the ways that destruction of the environment has been used as a colonial tool of dispossession, and also how there have been violent environmental consequences that, whether or not they were intentional, had significant harms on Native tribes and nations. So that's one of the primary lenses I try to look through that. And then what are the texts that are already existing in this area that I can work with? Like Jack Norton's history of genocide on the Klamath is really excellent, right? Yeah, in terms of sitting with the violence, I think that in the book, more generally, the first third is really looking at kind of histories of environmental violence, whereas the second third is really looking at histories of environmental or decolonial futurity. And I think that for me was always the balance, is like, what are the futures that are being brought into being, and how do we put the level of emphasis there so that when we're attending to some of this historical context, that's present, but also so many of those histories have been written. I think that Damon Atkins and Bill William Bowers' Where the Land, the Native History of California, is a really great example of how to do this sort of history in a way that acknowledges the harms but is focused on agency and the political progress of California Native people, both in terms of gains that different communities and tribes and nations have built, but also the coalitional kind of thinking and forms of action that are coming into view across the 20th century.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if that answers the
No,
question.
yeah, I think I was just ambling about trying to see the way through, because it's fascinating, the framing of the stories we tell and the impacts of them, and so I was just trying to flesh that out.
And one other thing I would say is that I'm really inspired by Sadia Hartman's work. She has this idea of critical fabulation. She's a Black Studies scholar looking at the histories of transatlantic slave trade, and then more recently, like Black queer survival in New York. But for one of the things that she points out, both that the archive can be a site of like spectacular violence, right? Like reading about history of slavery as a form of spectatorship and enjoyment, but then also that the construction of the archive itself is an act of violence. And I think that's the sort of care that I try to bring when I'm thinking about this archival work, is like taking these lives that shimmer in the archive seriously.
Okay, let's jump to our last topic about a chapter before we go to big picture. And it's something that is, present today, which is encampments. We've had legislation recently that has sought to criminalize encampments even more than they have been. And it was interesting reading your chapter about this, because I had a family member recently bring up Michael Schellenberger's book, San Francisco, to me. And it's interesting because there's a kind of a shared critical nature towards how governments are operating, but with totally different assumptions and totally different solutions. And the encampment thing is such a complicated one. Can you talk about what the term benevolent eviction is doing for a narrative about these kinds of encampments?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so I lived in Oakland from, I think, for a total of 4.5 years before I moved to Ohio, and then came back for another 2 years, or for about 6.5 years between, I don't know, 2014 and 2021.
So the period of real big change, yeah.
And I think one of the things that was really powerfully present to me is that the gentrification from San Francisco and the Silicon Valley, has there was a pincher effect on Oakland, right? Whereas Oakland was becoming more known in pop culture, or refashioned as a sort of trendier or more alternative place to be, and I think that was bringing a lot of displacement. Also, there's just a lot of tech money floating around the bay, messing with a lot of real estate markets and really escalating them very quickly. And in Oakland, what we have is there's such a population of people who have generational ties to the city, or deep autobiographical ties to the city, especially among the Black community, though not exclusively, and especially among POC communities, who are, for example, and just in the 2000s, rents rose 53% over 3 years, right? And then we were seeing another, after the recession, as the economy was recovering more, we were seeing renewed waves of gentrification and increase in rents. And I think part of the politics of encampment is a removal, a refusal to leave, and an indictment of the city's lack of care for its long-term residents, lack of interest in balancing sort of moves toward new development, toward kind of luxury housing.
Let me
City
jump in. Let me
administrators.
jump in real quick. I want to ask you, since you're bringing it up. So when you look at the views of the municipal or county level governments to address these issues, do you see it as kind of cynical, incompetent, structurally trapped by a lot of the bigger forces at work here? How do you view, not necessarily motive, but how they're operating?
I feel like, oh, what's her name? The former Oakland mayor who lived out of her car briefly.
I don't remember.
I've got in the chat, I'm just blanking on her name right now. But I would say, in general, I think the attitude is that, as a framing encampment as like an inconvenience to speculative capital, to like redevelopment. And I think that the move to open these sort of tough shed communities, A, it's really good PR. I do think that there's some ways in which I think it's operating from a sense of goodwill, but I also think that we talked before about like pivoting your kind of conceptual frameworks. And I think there's just like a real lack of care to the for the fact that like encamped people have their own perspective, right? Or like people who are being displaced have their own perspective on housing, their own framework for understanding what's happening to them, the systems they're caught up within. And I think the idea of moving encamped people into tough shed communities for 6 months and then filtering them into the broader set of social services with the knowledge that like most people are not going to be able to move back to Oakland, right? Yeah, I think that there's perhaps some good intentions there, but intentions aren't pure, and there is an unwillingness to entertain other perspectives or points of view.
Do you think what needs to happen is we need an evolution in our understanding of private property, public space, both, or another concept to reframe what's going on here using a different lens that's not just broached in the capitalist narrative?
Yeah, I think housing as a human right is a good place to start, right? I think making some room to acknowledge that like people who have like legacy attachments to places, especially somewhere like Oakland with such a rich history, I think that you can be mindful of that as you're creating policy or as you're revising or reimagining policy. I also think the move to criminalize is it's pulling a trump card, right? Anytime that I think often people recourse to domination or like this sorts of forceful management when you're trying to end a conversation. And it happens especially swiftly when people are implicated in ways they don't want to think about. And I think that happens at the microcosm. I think it happens across the macrocosm. Somewhere like Cobb on Wood, like there were issues to be dealt with, but so many of those issues were fostered by the city's refusal to provide sanitation, right? Or refusal to broker with these organizations that people have developed.
Let's take a step back and look at the big picture now. And I want to return to this concept of haunting. We're dealing with these narratives in the book of harm that's been done, a history of trauma and violence, a legacy of erasure, and then these specters that are following us throughout time and keep resurfacing. Now, I don't have a lot of background in ghosts. I played with some Ouija boards in high school. Since I was talking to some, I've also seen my fair amount of Casper. And I know that there is a concept of unfinished business, but then there's also a concept of just sometimes the ghosts are, as in Harry Potter, they just live in the castle and they're there and you become friendly and aware of them, and it's just a form of communication. So what do we do with a haunting, if that makes sense? Is it something to be fixed or resolved? Is it something to live with? Is it something to be modified and reframed? How do you think about it?
Yeah, this is where I think Gordon has one of her most beautiful moments in Ghostly Matter, as she talks about the act of talking to the ghost, right? Or really addressing the ghost and listening as a posture. And I think in a metaphorical sense, the specters or hauntings that we live with point to areas where I think listening is a really useful early step or early tool. And I also think in the material realm that they point us toward the unfinished act of accountability and reparations. I think of something like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, or some of the moves towards truth and reconciliation, albeit partial and compromised in Canada. California's made its own moves. It's much different in the current atmosphere of antagonism with the federal government, who's trying to open all the public lands to logging, right? But what's different is the state's ability to enact in relation to menace from the federal government. But I do think that that we're living in a moment of reckoning with colonialism intellectually at the form of consciousness, and also politically and even commercially, right? Where like California is returning trust land and access and management of land to Native tribes in some big ways in the past few years. I also think we've seen much on a smaller scale, private organizations doing that. There's a different tax burden that tribes take on when like land is passed as property that don't exist in the same way for trust. But trust relies on the legal system to maintain, and it's supposed to be a pretty strong form of sort of protection and perpetuity, opening a land to access, conservation easements or cultural trusts. But with the way things are going with the Supreme Court, I'm not as optimistic. I think it's a tough situation, the balance between trust, the return of property, and the tax burden that comes with it. But I think that we're at a moment where these are things that are happening, and there's a momentum that we can lend our shoulder to, right? And also listen. And I think in that way, these hauntings allow us opportunities to reimagine the future in ways that aren't overdetermined by choices that happen when our level of environmental knowledge, scientific knowledge, institutional knowledge was like very low. Our sense of history was quite distorted. In some ways, we live in a moment of incredible possibility to turn the ship. In the Central Valley, something like 10, maybe 20% of ag land is going to need to be retired by 2040, just in terms of like water availability and drought, right? And whose land that is, and whether it's small farmers or corporate holdings, will depend on the decisions we make. And I also think it presents an opportunity for, unfortunately, land back often happens at degraded land, right? I remember attending a conference in Delaware, where there was a land return and it was a former firing squad from the police, right? And so the land was like irradiated with lead. It needed to be remediated, but the tribe was very like was committed to that work, right? And I think in terms of farmland, if this land is not going to be commercially valuable for what it's been used for over 100 years, perhaps we can expand our sense of possibility and think about what it would mean to really take this period to invest in the land base of both recognized and unrecognized tribes and support movements toward tribal recognition, because so many California Native tribes were terminated in the 40s and 50s by the government. Their recognition was. Yeah. And I think that in some ways makes it, even with the mega fire, even with everything that's going on, makes it a really exciting time to be alive, because I think there are possibilities for, I don't know, for a really different kind of future under climate change, and where some of these impacts can bring people into more meaningful forms of alliance and building futures together.
Yeah, I was thinking about that recently. I had my drip irrigation system on my vegetable garden went out, and so
Oh no.
I had to kind of hand water, and I was just like, oh, yeah, I should come out here more often and have a relationship with my plants as opposed to automating. And it became for me in my head like this bigger metaphor of we alienate ourselves from nature often through the systems that we create. And while it might take more time, and I might have to set another task aside for the morning, going out and just watering my own garden, I think does more for my humanity than all these systems that we have in place. When I was reading your book, I was thinking about a lot of the, because your book is multidisciplinary, there's a lot of things going on there. And I was thinking about a lot of the kind of more traditional academic historians that I conduct interviews with. If one of those kind of more traditional academic historians read your book, what would you want them to take from it that then they would take to telling their own stories of California?
Well, that's a good question.
Because you're doing things and you're pulling in threads that maybe are outside the scope of someone writing a kind of a narrative history of some important period in California. So I was just curious if we need to revise how we tell stories in that way, how we write history using different tools that maybe a academic historian that was using a more conventional model wouldn't use.
One, it's tough because as an academic, you're within all these systems that want you to operate in this sort of conventional way, even at the same time that, like, when books break with convention, they can be really meaningful to that conversation. I guess one of my through lines is that California history should be polyvocal, and that should also mean that we're thinking across different ontologies, right? That California isn't inevitable. And I also tend to think when we're talking about California, we should be taking it back all the way to Spanish conquest, at least in terms of that framework. Alta California and California more generally, they changed hands politically, but so many of the environmental and commercial transformations have their roots in the colonial period or the period of conquest.
Let's close with my favorite section, which is book recommendations. What are a few books maybe that were important to you in the research for this book, or books in general you'd like to recommend to the audience about the subjects we've discussed today?
So I think Atkins and Bowers' We Are the Land was really helpful. Caitlin Reed's book settler cannabis about past cannabis cultivation on the Klamath is an incredible intellectual work. It's accessible for especially for an academic book and tells a really important history that's so crucial, so significant a part of California's culture and economy, cannabis is, but that's another unthought thing is like, where does it come from? What are the circumstances there? So those were really important to me. What else? So many people read Parable of the Sower and stop there, and I will tell you, Parable of the Talents is worth your time.
Yes.
Yeah. Other books that were really important to me. I read Almanac of the Dead while I was writing and revising this book, and it doesn't show up in here. But anyone who's read Almanac of the Dead knows there's a sort of reckoning. It's a long book, but it's also, there's so much going on. And I think that, I don't know, was just something I had going alongside for the last year of writing this book that was really great.
Do you
Yeah.
find it's helpful to read fiction when you're writing nonfiction?
I do think so sometimes. Yeah. Also because my brain gets tired and I need a different kind of food.
For sure, a balanced diet.
Yeah, I guess the last one I would say is Sri Muraga's play Heroes and Saints. A lot of people sleep on that play, but I think you could teach it in high school, certainly in college, when you're thinking about arts of California. It's an incredible piece. And especially with all the painful histories that have come to light with the UFW, I think that piece, that play both is infused with some of that history, but then brings it into this kind of human framework that doesn't always, that movements don't always get brought into that human dimension when we're talking about them. And I think that plays a really interesting, especially for, there's such a dearth of art about the Central Valley. And I think
Yes.
we have to really hold dear the pieces that go there because it's such a storyful place that doesn't get its stories told.
Couldn't agree more. Again, the book is California Futures, Haunted Ecologies, and Decolonial Relations. Last question for you. What are you working on next?
Yeah, I just finished in a book chapter about seasteading,
Oh,
like an
interesting.
academic book chapter about representations of the seasteading movement across some comic books, and Maddie Lipchansky's graphic novels, Boys Weekend, which is really good. I'm also working on some creative nonfiction. I'm doing a working on a memoir and essays. I'm also an MFA faculty at SJSU, so I'm working on a set of braided essays about, it's more in the memoir mode, but it engages with Umwelt and other species and how we think about, I often tell people if California Futures is the overstory, this book's the understory, where it's more domestic, more intimate, the level of scale is very different. But I'm thinking about our relationships with animals at the same time as I'm thinking about different cognitive worlds around mental health, neurodiversity, that kind of thing.
Awesome. Dr. Daniel Rivers, thank you so much for taking the time with me today.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.